Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night, perhaps. I don't know what time our listeners are listening, but I'm glad that you're listening to Talk With Me. I'm Marcia Epstein. I'm in Lawrence, Kansas, and our listeners, you may be anywhere. In fact, our guests may be a lot of different places, too. That's one of the cool things as well, that this is an opportunity to hear from people who are in different parts of this country, and now I can say, and in Canada and Mexico as well. I love doing this show. It is something that I would be listening to if I wasn't the one who was already making it, but I kind of know what's in the shows. I hope that our listeners enjoy it as much as I do, and I hope that it does the same thing for listeners as it does for me. It kind of fuels me in a way. I enjoy listening to the stories that get shared. I enjoy listening to the writing, and I'm distinguishing stories from writing because not all the stories that get shared are already in print. I love the conversations. I love the connection, and that's, to me, why I've really been featuring artists quite a lot, and mostly writers, because that fits so well with radio. I'm a huge believer that art is something that is vital, that it is a life force, that it fuels life, that it's so important to experience things from different parts of communication, not just mundane conversation, and conversation doesn't have to be mundane, but sometimes things get to sneak up on us, and I like that. And art is one of the ways that can happen. And sometimes messages sneak up on us and connect us and remind us we're not alone, and that's even better. And that really resonates with everything that I do in my social work. So I love, as I say, living at the intersection of art and mental health. And one of the people in that neighborhood is my guest today. And I'm going to start with his big name. Welcome, Charles Clifford Brooks III.
Thank you for having me.
I'm glad that this is the third time the Charm Show for 2017 and Cliff and me. So I'm really glad that we're doing this.
And it's a pleasure to be aboard.
Oh, good.
I am doing fantastic. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm looking outside and knowing that it's blue skies and green stuff because it's been raining so much. It's beautiful. And I love change. You know, it doesn't just have to be this change of season. I don't love time change in terms of daylight savings, but I love outside and it's beautiful. And that makes me happy. How about you?
I feel exactly the same. Nature to me is a driving force in my creations, whether it's my friendships, my writing, or the projects that come in between. The weather and being outside in it rejuvenates me.
Yeah.
And it's always a touch spot and a real touchstone, rather, in the things that I create.
Very cool. And I want to give a shout out to Scott Thomas Outlaw, who is one of your partners in the Southern Collective Experience, because Scott's the reason that you and I originally connected. How about that?
I know he's a friend, and I always try to say, like, I'm never out to flatter anybody, because flattery is just the nicest way to lie. But without Outlaw, this program with you would not be possible, but the Southern Collective Experience as it stands today would not be what it is without that brother.
Yeah, very cool. So people don't necessarily already know about some of you, your background, or this Southern Collective Experience, whatever that means. So I would appreciate if you fill us in a little bit about just some background stuff about you and the collective.
I'd love to. I was born near Athens, Georgia, and I've spent my entire life in this state. The Southern Collective Experience, though it does have Southern in its title, is not Southern-centric in the way people, when it first began, believe that it's only below the Mason-Dixon line. That's an extremely myopic way to view literature and the arts, and it cuts off the entire experience of expression throughout the rest of the nation and the world. Since I created the SCE, the whole concept has blossomed into areas that I never thought possible. There's a NPR radio show called Dante's Old South with WUTC's affiliate of NPR that will be the last Sunday of this month in April. And it's in every month that there is a fifth Sunday. And that sounds kind of cryptic, but actually with the hustle and bustle of all of the members and our busy schedules as a team and as individuals, that really every fifth month with a fifth Sunday fits us very well. It allows us to get a culmination of music and storytellers and poets, really that pop each and every time we're able to get into the station and record.
Wonderful.
There's a journal of culture called the Blue Mountain Review that we started a little over a year ago that comes out once a season. That comes out in its spring issue the first week of May. We like to come out with our issues about a month or a little longer into each season so that it's not lost in the slush of all the others. Mm-hmm. And that has brought in some of the most fascinating folks, from John Tribble to Robert Pinsky to the band Tennessee Werewolves and Appalachia Rather. And the readers, storytellers like Peter Restuccia and Shane Etter, the poets like myself and Outler, Hani Zweibel, Jennifer Avery, the spiritual bindings such as Casanova Green, the music of D.L. Yancey II, all these folks come in on the radio show and in the magazine in ways that I never could have foresaw. And they enrich my life. I mean, I've always said that the SCE is my greatest joy, and it truly is.
Yeah, wonderful. So lots of different art forms together. You're talking about storytelling and poetry and music. And all of that is what Southern Collective Experience is, right?
Also poetry, I mean, painting and photography as well. I mean, this month in our issue, we've actually sprawled out to include food, because that's the one art form that you genuinely do need more than all others, because you'll die without it. Uh-huh. So we have a firm foundation of what we want to create, but we leave this elasticity there to say, well, let's try this. Mm-hmm. Because if it doesn't work, it doesn't fall flat, and we've not found something that we've tried that really hasn't fit. Mm-hmm. So all of it together creates this symphony that's visual and that's audible and it's in song and in writing that kind of touches on all the senses.
Yeah, wonderful. How is the Southern Collective Experience built or building in terms of people who become part of that?
We have on our website, where you can find everything I mentioned and more, www.southerncollectiveexperience.com, as well as my own website, www.cliffbrooks.com, where you can find links to the submission page that's for the magazine, but also for those who feel that they get the same, if they read the magazine and they kind of read into the creations of each independent member, if they feel they have that same Dixie feeling, and what I mean by that is a unity and not being fragmented, but working together and supporting each other. The whole idea of the collective was to get away from the backbiting and the exclusion of others, while adhering to the same kind of fluid move forward that creates a identity that breaks the stereotypes that unfortunately artists truly have earned over the years, that we don't play well with others.
Ooh.
So if you find that this is something that right. So I mean, if this is something that again just strikes a chord of like, I feel that. I really urge those. We don't have a distinction or a level that you must be at, or a certain way that you write. When I have people say, well, you know, Clifford, I don't sound anything like you. Fantastic. You know, we want the cacophony of harmony and that gel that holds us together to be that we are varied, and not that we are trying to get to the same spot at the same time, but that we're all on our own journeys, maintaining and continuing our own individuality while still being part of the whole. It sounds utopian, I guess, on some notes, but really the practicality that art is a business, that it is something and a means that we can financially get ahead and pay our bills, that it's not being a sellout to be a success on all platforms of the idea that creation is a vocation. You know, these are things that we don't hide, but really raise as something that we want as a whole and we want to share with others.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And in terms of live performances, do you have a certain part of the country that you all tend to perform in, since it obviously requires people getting together to perform?
Right now, we have the collective sessions, and these are open mic events that are hosted by the collective that have collective members in it. But we want the rest of the world to come in and see these things that I've talked about being friends, being family, supporting one another, offering kind, constructive criticism and not slashing at one another, proving through action, allowing these people to see that we are in action, everything we say in words. Mm-hmm. We had our first collective session about 2 months ago and had over 60 people show up. And our next one is in, we have them now at the Good Acting Studio in Marietta, Georgia. The next one being on April 29th from 7 to 9 p.m. And the love that we have received and been able to give has been outstanding. In a little bit north of that, in Pickens County in North Georgia, we have the Visions of Verse in the Pickens County Library. And those vary, but we maintain those on a Saturday. And as we move forward, we want to spread the collective sessions as far out as we can. We have members in New York, New Jersey. We have members out in California. And they are taking the same idea, the same concept, making it their own and having these pods, as it were, of the collective sessions in their neighborhood.
Very cool. That's great. So all over. And this is such a great time for connecting with arts and these kind of webs of this being connected to this. I mean, I see so much how people are inspired by each other, and there's that when we need that nurturing ourselves. And part of it, like you're saying, is that art is a business and art needs to have financial support. You know, there's that part. So yeah, I mean, we got to have that. And there's also the emotional side of knowing there are other people out in the world that you're connected to who are doing the same kind of good stuff that you're doing. And some of what you're trying, they're learning from, and some of what they're doing, you know, it works both ways. And to me, that's what I hear when you talk about the Southern Collective experience, is that it's all about connecting in a really positive way.
Exactly. I mean, it's when I first sat down and began to pen about 10 years ago, this idea that I had about the Southern Collective experience, that's what I wanted above all else. Because when I would go to poetry readings or I would see MFA programs, you had this minority of really talented people that just got chewed on by the majority. And as a side note, the Southern Collective Experience has partnered up with Reinhardt University that I sat in, and we actually performed for their MFA program that's just got off the ground last year. And it's the first time that I saw this same drive for excellence, yet room for improvement, that no one knows everything. Now, how horrible it would be that if you did wake up one day and realize you knew everything, because that would strip you of the joy of what's next.
Yeah.
The Reinhardt University program had us down to perform, and there was three or four Outler included that came down and kind of showed them what we were about. And then I went to the next day an event where they all got up in the MFA program and read, and I sat there in amazement. And thought, you know, we need to create a new magazine other than the Blue Mountain Review that's now called One, that's done and edited by Casanova Green, who's in the MFA program and a brother of the Southern Collective Experience, that shows that, no, the SCE is not the only entity that holds these things as virtues, but that we are willing and eager to connect with other entities, whether they be colleges or other reading groups, to create this family, this web, that's the perfect word for it, who's that has threads that spindles out into every genre and brings in the best of all. Yeah. And it's been it's honestly been a joy to be a part of.
Yeah. And when you say that, I have to say a little bit to you and our listeners about something that I'm involved with, which is the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture. And no, it's not a government thing. Yes, it is a people's movement. And it's all about, number one, belonging. It's about bringing people together who are passionate about arts and culture and know that our communities need to be paying attention to arts and culture, not just finances when big decisions are getting made. And, you know, examples include filmmaker Betty Yu in New York City, who is very involved in her Chinese American community to fight gentrification that's displacing Chinese American businesses and families. You know, that there are all kinds of things that are happening with artists leading the way or artists being really instrumental. And the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture is one of those ways of being part of and recognizing that you are part of this national community, not just those people who you come in contact with face-to-face or on your social media. So if people want to find out more about that, the website is usdac.us. The U.S. Department of Arts and Culture. Cool things happen, like a poetic State of the Union each year that's built out of story circles that happen across the country. So connecting with artists and artists enhancing all of us is so important. So just had to say that.
I absolutely agree. I mean, it's people, you have to walk this careful line, not to sound haughty, but I mean, you nailed it right on the head in that the arts has always been the song of freedom, and it's always been the Bible, as it were, to our spiritual beliefs, our fight against gentrification, our ability to maintain our place in the world and not apologize for it, nor thumb someone in the eye to say it's better than where they're from. It's the only way that we all survive is to make sure that we maintain a truth in ourselves.
That's so important. Being honest, being authentic, genuine. Yeah, I love all that. So you are a creator of what kinds of arts? People may not know that.
I had a very odd beginning in poetry because for the first, it's probably everybody, no one really, you know, wakes up, I'm going to be a poet. But when they do, that definitely becomes something to, you know, devote true grit to. But for the first 20 years of my writing career, I did exclusively fiction and creative nonfiction. And then about the age of 35 or 36, I had an agent in New York who had read some of my fiction and asked for this novel idea that I'd mentioned in another interview. And as I sent him off the packet of my prose, I thought, well, I'll show him that I have a little more breadth and some more areas. And I had about three or four poems, maybe half a dozen, that I thought were truly worth somebody's time and reading. Well, this is Monday, about a week and a half, 2 weeks go by. Friday at 4:30, I get a call, and it's from New York, and it's my agent's secretary, and she says, you know, Dave is really impressed with your prose, but this poetry just really sings to him. And I checked the number again, thinking it was one of my friends trying to pull a joke because I never considered, and I'm not, I'm working on my humility, but I'm not falsely humble, but I truly did not believe this was the way it was supposed to go down. And I thought, well, okay, well, I'm willing to talk about that too. And so Dave gets on the phone and says the same thing, like, Cliff, you know, I definitely want to work on this fiction, and your humorous nonfiction really tells a great story. But brother, this poetry sings of a place that's not just from the South, but makes other people, you know, I think, you know, love where they're from too, and reflect on what they love about home. And so I'm like, Yeah, that's what I was shooting for. Absolutely, absolutely. That's what I was going for, brother. And he says, do you have any more? Uh-huh. And this is where the lies began. I said, yes, amen. I have computers I've had to shut down. They're so chock full of poetry. I have hallways full of file cabinets with poetry. Now, remember, this is Friday at like 4:30. He says, fantastic. Can I have 80 more pages by, this ain't Monday? The lies continue. Yes, you don't want a Pony Express right now, brother? That's a weekend? You really want to wait that long? On the outside, I sounded as brave as I do now. On the inside, I was crying like a 13-year-old girl. I'm not trying to pull any wool over your eyes, but so I sat down, turned on my bipolars, and over a weekend, I blasted out a song that became the first book in my two-book first release called Whirling Metaphysics. And so those 80 pages, of course, when I look back over them now, those first drafts were horrible. God bless him for not shutting down the whole business on me there right then at that moment. But I, at the same time that I began to really hone in and separate myself, and I didn't read any poetry. I listened to only music because I was terrified that if I did begin to study up on poetry, that some of their fingerprints of those who came before me would show too heavily in my work. So I really, and people say, oh, well, you know, this project that started at this point that I'm explaining only took you 3 years. It was an extremely intense 3 years. And I'm not trying to bemoan that or make that more or less than what it is, but I ate, slept, and breathed poetry. Mm-hmm. And I came to create poetry in not so much as the way people are really accustomed to it as a poet, but more as a musician. And what I mean by that is that it became more of me creating syllables, consonant, vowel sounds, more like putting notes on a scale than words on a page. And many musicians picked up on that. And since I've had the book come out in 2013, musicians pick up on that first and have come to me. And there have been really neat side projects of turning my poetry into music. As Whirling Metaphysics came to an end, Whirling Metaphysics is my youth up until I felt this divide, and I got to a point where I was like, well, I feel like I'm telling a different story. Let me remove this from this Whirling Metaphysics context and put it into a now me as you know at 35, mm-hmm. and it became a separate book called The Draw of Broken Eyes, mm-hmm. and it was a young man sloughing off the insecurities of youth, yet still heartbroken and all of these very melodramatic themes that you hear so much in poetry while trying to stay away from the doldrums and depression of that kind of growth. Mm-hmm. And so when Gosley Books picked it up and published it, we decided to publish both books together. Mm-hmm. That's why the title seems so hellaciously long, The Draw of Broken Eyes and Whirling Metaphysics. Uh-huh. It's actually two books in one.
You know.
And the exciting part about that is that my new book, Athena Departs, Gospel of a Man Apart, and my first book are being published separately by Backlash Press out of England. And my first book will be re-released in hardback, and Athena Departs in hardback for the first 100 copies at the end of this month where I'll start my tour. Mm-hmm. And it shows my growth as a poet. I didn't go back through my first two books and try to overhaul all of it and change it because it would rob people of seeing this feeling of lack of innocence, loss of innocence, and then regaining of it in Athena Departs, where it's, again, it's all autobiographical. Mm-hmm. My poetry is from a place of honesty, where I don't use metaphor or cryptic imagery to hide anything, because to me, poetry is fiction stripped away of its foggy veneer. And that's not to slight fiction at all, where what I mean by that is in fiction you can say, well, that character is a culmination of a couple of folks I've met through life. No, that character is not really me. That's somebody that I didn't like in life. Poetry is you standing there naked in front of an audience saying, this is who I am, this is what I believe, this is where I came from, these are the people that are dear to me. And it forces you to be honest, and mm-hmm. I kind of hammer away on this idea of honesty and truth that, you know, those who write will say, well, of course. But at the same time with poetry, what I found is that recent movements have closeted away poetry in this what in the world are you talking about kind of genre, whatever you want to call that. And so without being a valiant soldier of truth, my main drive, if I leave nothing behind in poetry, it's that you must maintain your honesty, your integrity, and tell your story in stark terms while at the same time keeping the flowers in the garden alive, so that people have those experiences along with you, while allowing that beautiful space that only poetry gives the reader to see themselves into that, and to see their own home, their own loved ones, their own sadness, their own joy and bliss. It's a very intricate process that has been a blessing in my life, because it makes me focus. You know, people have always said that I have a very heavy ADD side to my personality, and it's true, but in poetry, it's one of the few things, like music, that makes me concentrate on a finite single point, and it takes all of my energy to do it. So it's an exercise in meditation as well.
Yeah, beautiful. And I know for me, just briefly, I think of poetry as having so much meaning and impact in small amounts of words, you know, that to me, when you said about stripping away the veneer from the fiction, that's to me what I see in poetry that really appeals to me. Is,
I agree.
It's like, look at these lines, and there's so much there, and my brain's creating pictures and imagining the scents and the looks and the, you know, the people and all this stuff. And it's like, my brain creates from those potent words, and I love that.
Yes.
Yeah. And so, as we've tantalized people with descriptions of your writing, this would be a perfect time, if you're willing, for you to share some.
I would love to. I will start with a piece from The Draw Broken Eyes called Prayer. And in recent weeks, I've been getting back to faith, and it's never a topic that I wish to beat anyone over the head with, nor lead someone to believe that the way that I have come to a spiritual sense of self to be the only way. Yet at the same time, put enough identity into it to show that same sense of place and time. And prayer is also one, like you said before, where I really try to strip away all the adjectives and adverbs and flowery vocabulary to distill to its essence the idea of what I think of as a prayer. Okay. And this is the way that goes. Prayer. All of us are born from sparrows, a string of dreams. Grow firmly between rocks and roots, dear muses. Sway as wind brings spring. Supernal watchmen wish we would notice their urge to join in. By and by, Lord, by and by. So let's woo them into our fold and sing redemption song. We rowdy few shall rejoice and throw dice with angels. Prayer.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
And you said that poem Prayer is from The Draw of Broken Eyes.
So yes, ma'am.
The early, right? The early Cliff Brooks. Cool.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. And we're going to take just a quick break here and hear from a couple of the businesses that sponsor LawrenceHitz.com. I want to say thank you to Daniel Smith, who produces this show. And I want to say thank you to Cliff Brooks for joining me today. And listeners, we will be right back. And welcome back to Talk With Me and today's guests, Charles Clifford Brooks III, otherwise known as Cliff. And I have to mention, and this thing, the Southern Collective Experience, that is an important part of who he is and who he's with. And so lots to talk about. And you just shared that beautiful poem, Prayer, and mentioned that although it's from your early book, The Draw of Broken Eyes, it also is relevant to you in the world right now, that you're going through some changes and getting back to your faith. And so it's I'm sure, a new meaning to this poem, even to you as you read it now.
And what folks at home listening to this don't realize is that you nailed this on the head without me uttering a word to you about this. That is scary. That, like, how does she know that? Get out of my head. That's one of the things that I was like, well, if we talk about it, I'll fit it in here. But the neat part about maintaining the truth that we were talking about in the first half of the show is that I'll go back and read pieces that I composed way back when, uh-huh, and find that when I keep to the truth, and I've had fantastic editors that when I would say, you know, we as writers will, especially poets, we'll start out real strong and then we'll get to a point that's painful or maybe it to us seems a little shameful. A great editor, I cannot stress enough, that's a third party that can look at this and like a heat-seeking missile say, Clifford, I can see right here where, you know, you're starting to muddle a little bit. I can see where you're getting strong right here, but I can see your fear in these lines because they don't really fit and they seem to be more of a smokescreen than an apology than maintaining your truth. With the spirit and with growing up, dealing with issues like mood disorders, ADD, things like that, senses of self that I believe where diagnoses may sometimes do more harm than good, really delving into these things without the melodrama and keeping it true to self, that years later when I go back and read them, I'll find meaning in them that I didn't intentionally put the first time, but don't make it any less. But in some cases, it means more to me than it did originally. Uh-huh. You're absolutely right. You're uh-huh. absolutely right. And prayer is one of those poems.
Yeah, cool. And I think that's, to me, that's, well, here's my plug. That's why it's so great to buy the books, to have the words in print. And I'm a big fan of pages as opposed to electronic, and people read wherever you read. But when you have that book and you are able to pull it out again and the world has changed and you have changed personally and you read this and you think, I always loved that poem, but man, it speaks to me now in this whole new way. And I think that's one of the gifts of poetry, again, with all that meaning that's packed into those shorter phrases than long narrative fiction.
I absolutely agree.
But man, the context is there, and the pages. I love looking at poetry on the page. I love having the slowness of looking at those words. And on the computer screen, whatever technology screen, doesn't do it for me in the same way. So I'm just saying, folks, when you can, go to readings, buy from the poet. When you can't get to the readings, you know, check and see if the press that publishes that book has it for sale at that point. Check your local independent bookseller and see if they can get it for you if they don't already have it. You know, do those closest possible to the creator, artist, as you can, and really support that work that you love. You know, that's important.
I agree. And it's not to say that I want to put this on the record, as it were, about my current press, but Backlash Press through Gretchen Heffernan has been a godsend. Her ability to read your work and get a sense of your work, help you organize your thoughts, help you, and her, you know, but in the love of the page, I'm the same way. I'm a book nerd. And not just that I'm a writer and love to read, but in hardback, I love the feel of a matte finish versus glossy, and then the heavier paper that holds the ink and the what font you use. Uh-huh. These little nuances she does not lose. And Backlash Press has a theme and a branding, a trademark that is covered in all their designs, that brings in the books from all authors under the same umbrella, not just in the house of Backlash Press, but in their design as well. Oh. And like I said, they're going to be reissuing in hardback my first book, The Draw Broken Eyes of Worldly Metaphysics, at mm-hmm. the same time that they released my second book, Athena Departs, Gospel of a Man Apart. And we, as of this morning, we're just going over some of the small final details before we get to the manufacturing process that alleviates so much stress. That mm-hmm. of, you know, because nothing, you know, I'm slowly coming to an acceptance that Neil Gaiman, the author from England, once said that you can have a million different editors go over your work and you're going to find a mistake at some point. Mm-hmm. And I don't, you know, with other writers, you know, it's like, you know, with Proust, you know, he was down in his last edit of like, do I put the comma here or do I put the comma there? And I do believe that at that point you need to let it go and let it get out into the world. But at the same time, you know, understanding that, you know, mistakes can be made. And what I found with my first book coming out and the small mistakes that I found throughout there, it's weird that it wasn't spelling or punctuation, but the movement of a line that it created in me a new sense of the poem. It didn't change the meaning. It didn't change the soul of it. But in the reading of it, oddly enough, and again, that's where the without trying to sound haughty or overwrought here, that the divine fire, the divine spark that's in authors or writers, poets, photographers, artists, or you know, from lawn care maintenance to garbage men to neurosurgeons, anything that you find that you can't let go, that you can't live life without doing, that it creates its own soul. You know, when you let that book go, when you let that good work that you love out into the world, it can't help but find a home in many. Mm-hmm. And that's why, I mean, I agree with you. And if the power goes out or if your cell phone dies, if you have the book with you, you can still read it. Yeah, you know, I mean, you won't have that cursor problem or, oh, wait, I went past the page too much when you're reading as well. That's, you know, yes. And again, people have, you know, in this doing that, you know, kids today, but in this day and age, you know, that is such a prevalent part of it that, you know, I do and am a fan of having an electronic version for those who like that. But mm-hmm. in readings, you know, when I go to open mics, I've seen those who read off their tablets or read off their phone, they get lost where they'll scroll too far or they'll lose themselves mm-hmm. on the page where I had a really talented editor and friend named Ruth Winham, who does Connell Wilde readings in Atlanta, Georgia, that helped me see, because I became too reliant upon typing the poems and editing, you know, solely on the computer, just because it was more convenient at the time. But she printed off my books and said, you know, write on these pages, put your pen to the page, put your fingers on each line. And that did bring back the joy of the whole creation process. And that's a tidbit that I've learned that I like to spread on to others, is to get away from the computer, go outside, take your notebook with you, lay down in the grass, let the wind blow over you. My girlfriend, Tracy Kincaid, is one of those who really, when I was so wound up in the intricacies of the business side, the organization of the Southern Collective Experience, said, honey, come outside and lay down with me. Uh-huh. You know, come outside and just get away from it. Bring your notebook with you. You know, she was there with me as we sat with Ruth and heard her and said, you know, let's do this whole process. Read to me what you're writing. And it brought back that song. It revitalized my sense of self as a poet. And it's something that, you know, as I look outside right now, I want to do it, you know, every day. And it keeps my life and my writing fresh.
Yeah. So at this point, then, you're saying that you actually create your poetry pen on paper to begin with.
Yes.
As opposed to
I'm one of those poet nerds that has that little notebook with them all the time. I have very tolerant friends that when the muse hits me and they're in the middle of a sentence and I break away to write, they'll just pause and let me do it. You know, they'll say a little prayer and slap me in the head. But, you know, and that's where the collective comes in, because we're all of the same idiosyncrasies that we understand one another and our need for that immediate stepping away. Uh-huh. But it always at the same time leads me to remember a story that Tom Waits, musician, said, where he was driving in LA traffic and this muse struck him at that moment and said, you need to write this down. And he was about to get stressed and said, you know, man, if I don't write this down right now, I'm going to lose it and that song will be gone forever. And he said, wait, no, just pause. And he said aloud to the muses, don't you see I'm driving? Don't you see I'm in the middle of something right now? Can't you come back at a more convenient time? And so the one thing too to impress upon artists is don't take yourself so seriously, you know. So, you know, remind yourself, you know, this is important, but getting into a car accident and maybe not walking away is far more important than that, you know, that song idea or poem that may not last.
Or, and I probably said this to you before, because I've told you that you remind me of the comedian Mitch Hedberg, as he would say, if he couldn't find paper and pencil, then he had to just decide that it wasn't going to be funny anyway, you know?
Okay. Right. If that muse is going to be that inconsiderate, you know, I'll just wait for one that is, and I'm sure that'll be better than this one anyway.
That's great. That's really great. So I wonder if, in terms of your sharing poetry, would you be willing to share one next from the Whirling Metaphysics?
I would. I'd like, and I have a few from them, I think, the parts as well. But I've already found one.
Okay.
I have one from Whirling Metaphysics here. It's a diptych, actually, and this is part two. And the poem is called Appalachian Exile. and I grew up majority of my life in around the Appalachian Mountains. And this is about a real life trip I took out into an area that I used to go with my dad. And I went there by myself. And this is the experience in the part two that I experienced. So it's called Appalachian Exile, part two. Alone, his car coasts along, beaten by branches. Past a house abandoned, there are no hands left to pick blackberries. Hearth and half chimney jut up like the home's tombstone. Roof, front porch, shutters, all devoured by the earth. Above brambles, kudzu smothers a telephone pole. Moving forward, mountains begin to stand taller. Brought here by his father, he returns as a man having spent too long in the city. Deeper still, farther away, tall weeds lead to a fertile cathedral. Whippoorwills alight trees growing closer together. Ghosts of other loners, like the heat, wave. Chest bare, stomach and buttocks exposed, he bravely dances in the sun. Into a swimming hole, long legs leap, body washed by real water. Loose roots, like gnarled fingers, reach past soil into this river. Moss-slick rocks, now disturbed, cast silt around him. Floating, deserted, happy, he is a wren. This cold river, a sleeping mountain lion. Appalachian Exile.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
I'm such a lover of nature and also of old buildings. And so, you know, as you talk about that house and then move into just the nature part away from the house, it's like I'm seeing those in my imagination. And I love that. I love that. You know, and I think about, you know, when you talk about the water and, you know, the feeling of water on our skin, and it's just, there's, like you said, it's all those senses are brought into that poem.
Thank you.
Yeah.
If I could continue that, the Appalachian Exiles with my dad, and in Athena Departs, Gospel of a Man Apart, I took the folks that were most precious to me, those who I couldn't really grasp, and I knew at the time could not explain due to all the emotions that my first books were bringing out of me. In my second book, Athena Departs, I finally got around to describing and touching on my mama and the indelible love and support she's given me through my entire life. That when it seemed that everyone else had kind of lost faith in me, she never wavered. And I cannot thank her enough. And she's the final rung of my editorial gamut, as it were. She has to read everything that I've written, and she's great at it. Just to make sure that I'm not saying anything, because she's always, you know, she's like, if you ever embarrass me, I will cut you. So mama, you know, as an aside, you need to be a little bit afraid of your parents. You know, daddy just says, you know, I'll put you in a hole so deep that God can't find you. I'm like, why are y'all threatening me so much? And it keeps me on my toes, literally. And this poem called Promise to Mama, it tackles my issues with addiction in the past and my apologies to her and my really kind of reinforcing with the public and to her and within myself that without her, it's not just that these books would not exist. I believe that very seriously that I would not exist. Uh-huh. And so I'll read this poem now called Promise to Mama. You told me Tuesday it's time to simmer for my heavy mind's sake. A son shouldn't be so good at making his mama's heart break. Now, I won't say how I got lost just yet, because hell is listening for me to spill my secret. Don't go blaming bad luck, because a restless soul is my undoing. I'm overdrawn at the Bank of Legion due to the price of a few sinister seasons. So I sing spirituals and think of sermons I've missed. there's a debt to deal with from damage done to my wrist. Yet the scars ensure I don't misplace the memory of your undeserved sorrow. You won't weep in the rain again, Mama. And my veins will be clean tomorrow. Fate of a self-destructive son, you instinctively let my hide slide. But I shall not. I cannot. When I sit down with my misdeeds, it's obvious all I'm going to do is fall short of a picket fence, the wife of a quiet life, and you. Promise the mama.
That's amazing. And to me, that's one of those poems that when you read that to an audience, they're going to be all those people in the room going, me too, man, how did he say that? I haven't been able to say those words, but that's me too. And then they know they're not alone. And then they can let go of some of the shame of some of what they've walked through to get where they are in that moment. I mean, that's huge and so beautiful.
Thank you. And you nailed, I mean, you, I've lost the ability to speak. You nailed it on the head. It poetry and music and song, the use of letters and words remove the sense of loneliness.
Yeah.
That I feel that too. I'm going to go hug my mama. I'm going to go call my mama right now. You know, it's in my life, I don't even turn my ringer on, but if mama or daddy call, you know I'm going to answer that phone because they'll call back till it dies and then somehow find me with that parent GPS and beat me to death. So, you know, if that reminds you to call your mom and daddy and tell them how much you love them, then God, so be it.
Yeah. And I want to make sure people heard that is from the book that's coming out, Athena Departs.
Yes,
Gospel
ma'am.
Of a Man Apart. And
yes,
tell people more about that and how they can get it and when it's coming out and all that good stuff. That was such a beautiful poem, and that's only one of what people will find there.
Yes. Backlash Press, www.backlashpress.com, will be coming out with the reissue of my first book, The Draw Broken Eyes and Whirling Metaphysics, and my second book, Athena Departs, Gospel of a Man Apart. Athena Departs literally picks up where the first book left off. And the insecurities without being a braggart, the spiritual sense of self without being, without pontificating on falsehoods and the idea that I've all got it figured out. It really takes those years from 36 to 42 as of today with the new edit, the man that I've become now. And it's never to stand up and say, pay attention to me, but to listen to this song and see if you too feel the same way, that if you sing in a similar fashion, if it takes you to the same place.
Yeah. And so how soon does this become available?
Both books will be available for sale at the very end of this month, April 2017, and through the press. And it will also be, Backlash Press has distributors in Europe and in America. So you'll be able to get them through your libraries, your independent bookstores, your Barnes & Nobles. But again, as you've mentioned before, I can't say enough, please support your independent bookstores. They are a struggling breed, though there's a strong sense of self and that they're coming back in stride. But go there first and see if you can support them.
Yeah. And so far, this becomes a trilogy of poetry rooted in different segments of your life.
Yes,
and
ma'am.
So ideally, we read those in sequence, maybe not, but there'd be some beauty in seeing this is how his work progressed. And if I reflect on my own life, you know, I can identify this is what I thought I knew when I was 18. And this is how I was living when I was in my 20s, if you're through that period and beyond. And It'll be a great gift for people to do some reflection and to look at what has helped them get to the good parts of where they are right now. Because sometimes we stop looking at that. Sometimes we get overwhelmed by the hard stuff and we forget there's brightness in every single day. And some of that is luck And some of that is our hard work, and some of it is nudges from people who love us so much that they're there for us through all kinds of mischief and more.
Yes. If I could just take that and put that on the back of my book, I would. That's it. That's definitely how I was when 18, how I laughed at that guy who was 18, how I stayed out of jail, how I've not been so lucky. But it is. I mean, it's the gamut of true intention and then the whimsy of the world itself.
Mm-hmm. Because there's both, man. Sometimes we get, I am not a believer that life only gives us what we can handle or what we need. I think sometimes we have bad luck. I think sometimes we make mistakes. I get that too. But sometimes I think we just have bad luck and we still find ways, hopefully we find ways to pull through those and we help each other. And I will say again, I think when people hear at a reading or on this radio show or wherever, if you hear it or you read it, somebody else's words of their experiences that it snuck up on you in that song lyric or in that poem or in that story, you know, or maybe it's through dance and painting and sculpture and other art, you know, that reminder that you've got stuff going on for you that other people have walked that walk, and maybe you're at a similar place or maybe walked a little farther than you have. And it gives you hope that, okay, this guy at the mic, he's where he is right now. And he's been in this place where I am, and maybe I can get from here to a good place too. And, you know, that's more than just it gets better. It's that experience. And that gets me back to when you talk about when you, as the Southern Collective experience does events, when you're in front of people, that one of the gifts that you provide is letting people experience this set of different artists working together and clearly loving each other and what they do, and also being able to call each other out for bullshit if that needs to happen, or supporting each other through mistakes or whatever it is, you know, but being real together.
Exactly. And that's why, I mean, even if when you see the photographs, and we're very big on video because not everybody can be there. So, I mean, how do we convey that? And it's always been through action. You'll see very few photos of us posed anywhere because that doesn't show what we're trying to convey, and the fact that, you know, we don't roll our eyes secretly and, you know, and whisper to one another, man, they suck. You know, it is very much like you said, it's like, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to lay down the bullshit card there, brother. You know, like, no, I saw you came. You were strong, but there towards the end, you started to get a little weak, but you do it in a way that doesn't make the person feel objectified. And doesn't make them feel ashamed. You're able to say it with a laugh, and it's not a passive aggressive, which, I mean, if anything should be rewarded with a punch to the throat, it's passive aggressive behavior and language. We're very not raw but real with one another. You know, we're honest without being cruel to one another. And the ability for us at the end to work through mistakes and still be able to laugh and hug and be closer family than we were to before, that's the whole point of this. That's what the Southern Collective was created to imbue and to recreate in other people's lives.
Yeah. And you know, that thing about mistakes, you know, I have heard people, I remember being at a poetry slam here, and somebody who is an amazing slam performer, and he's really known for that and really powerful. And he was starting this piece and he froze. And he said, "This has never happened to me before." And then he worked through it. And it was like, that was huge. It was real. It was genuine. And it was a gift to everybody in the room to know we can work through things. And in a similar way, one of the fun things that I get to do with art each summer is help with a camp that's called Girls Rock Lawrence. And it's a national camp movement where rock and roll is used as a way to bring female and trans and gender nonconforming youth together with, you know, they create music, but they also learn a lot and connect and all this cool stuff happens. And so it's the set of women musicians that founded this here in our community. They're all experienced musicians. They've all played a long time. And so for the first camp, they wrote this little song for the campers, and they were getting ready to perform it on, let's say it was day three of the 5-day camp. Everybody performed it many times at this point. And the lead guitarist gets up, and suddenly she can't get the chord sequence right. And so she starts the song, and she stops. And she starts the song, and she stops. And then she starts it, and it goes smoothly. And all those youth got to experience, there's no shame in making a mistake, man. You just move through it, and you get where you need to go. And that's a huge life lesson. I love that.
Me too. Me too, because it shows the humanity. Again, it removes that idea that you have to be in some state of perfection in order to get up and read your work.
Yeah.
That everyone's growing in the same time span and never really getting to themselves. And that's what drives art, is that you know, like I said, it's like how boring life would be if you figured everything out, how boring it would be if you found out everything of yourself. Once you got to that point, what else do you write about? Mm-hmm. You know, self-discovery seems to me to be the lifeblood of creation.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And we are getting to this last couple minutes of today's show. And so I want to make sure that our listeners hear a little bit more from you before we end. You being Charles Clifford Brooks III, you being with the Southern Collective Experience, and your website, cliffbrooks.com. People want people to know you with just a little final statement. How about that?
Okay. The Southern Collective Experience, the website by the same name, www.southerncollectiveexperience.com, is a cacophony of different voices from different walks of life, from men and women, all religions. It's the idea that the single common thread is the love of art in each other, that individuality is just as important as the group as a whole, and that all within it and those who are affiliated with it strive to have this single notion that art is life and art maintains life in others. We don't stand as a pinnacle to say that we have all the answers or that we are right in all cases. And we look forward to those who have a different idea, a different concept, a different opinion, to voice that to us, to make us more aware of ourselves and more aware of them. We're open to those who wish to go to our submission page and be a part of this, to send us an application with their work and samples of what they've done and where they're going and their personal philosophies. My books, The Draw of Broken Eyes and Whirling Metaphysics, as well as my new book, Athena Departs, Gospel of a Man Apart, is coming out through Backlash Press, www.backlashpress.com, at the end of this month, April 2017, and I will begin touring in May of this year with other members of the group, as well as individually all over the South and beyond. And I will have updates on my Facebook pages. All of these things and the different radio shows and magazines affiliated with the collective also have Facebook pages, so please go check out that and like those so that we can send you updates from there as well.
Yeah.
I cannot thank you enough for having me on these shows. That hearing the way you see me again, it, you know, as much as it makes my senses aware and calls me out of my own themes that I wasn't going to mention, but you got me on. this show is priceless to keeping me fresh in my game and aware of myself, and I simply cannot thank you enough.
Thank you, Cliff. It's delightful, and I want to invite you. You have sent me a few little life mottos of your own. Do you have one of those you'd like to share at the end?
Oh, this is where I've got to tread so carefully.
words are okay.
there's one that I don't aim for anybody, but I don't swerve to miss them either. That's not meant to be belligerent. But my mama's like, why do you say these things? Because I don't create these memes. Actually, fans or those in the group will take a photo and put it with them, and then they'll launch them on Facebook. And I won't even know they're on Facebook until my mama's raging on me, because now she's got Facebook. So I've got to really be PG-13. God bless you, Mama. I love you. I really do. And Daddy, thank you for putting up with me. But it's the idea that, you know, I'm not out to thumb anybody's eye, you know, but at the same time, I will stand firm in my resolve. And that's something that I think artists, that we become too shaky to stand firm, that yes, I mean, don't try to aim for somebody that's not, you know, that don't, you know, get behind the wheel and try to, you know, swerve to make someone's life miserable. At the same time, if someone's going to put themselves in your way and set out to do harm to you, stand firm in your beliefs. Most times being silent is the best answer, but if called out, be honest and kind and genuine. And also the idea that art is a dream, and that dream is our life. And that life is what we put on the page or in song or in color to make others sing and dance and be in the room with us as we pray.
Beautiful. Thank you, Cliff. Thank you, listeners. This has been a fabulous show. And so long.
Thank you.